This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Buckyballs, anyone? Well, President Bush has pledged nearly $5 billion in federal money to nanotechnology, that is, reducing substances to bits that are one nano or one billionth of a meter. Some of those nanoparticles are called buckyballs because under very powerful microscopes, these tiny bits of matter look like the geodesic domes that were championed by the futurist Buckminster Fuller, and so buckyballs. But actually, the nanotech future is here. Nanotechnology has already been used in Pentium chips, sunscreen, and wrinkle-free and stain-resistant clothing. What's more, there's promise of nanotechnology helping cure cancer with those bitty particles infiltrating cancer cells in our bodies. However, that easier infiltration could also work against us if those manufactured nanoparticles entered our bodies unwanted. Some research is showing that they can act as poisons when added to the environment, causing swift brain damage in fish and lung damage in rats. And so today, with all of this swirling around us and a lot of that work going on here in North Carolina, we ask, what exactly is nanotechnology? Where and how will it be used? And do those nano-sized particles pose a threat to our health and environment? And does the general public know much about it? Joining us right now on the line from Rice University Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology is Kristin Kalinowski. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Melinda.
Well, exactly how small are we talking here when we talk about nanometers and nanoparticles?
Anywhere from 1 to 100 nanometers, which puts that about 50 to 100,000 times smaller than the width of a single human hair.
That's very small. That's very small.
Very small. It's not something that we can see with our unaided eye.
Right. But as I understand, these particles exist naturally. But what we were talking about with the technology is synthesizing them, of man making those small, very small pieces.
Yes, there are naturally occurring nanoparticles, particles that derive from man-made processes. If you burn anything, you're going to be creating nanoscale materials of carbon, probably, and other materials. It also comes from welding, from ocean spray, actually, has nanocrystals of salt in it. So there are many naturally occurring nanomaterials, but the excitement of the technology is coming from the materials that we specifically engineer to get a certain property.
Yeah. So what is the big attraction of going small here? Why is it so important? And what is all that excitement you're talking about by making things so very small?
One of the things that has been observed with making particles at this size is that they start to exhibit properties that the materials don't exhibit when they're in a larger form. So, for example, we may have new electrical properties or mechanical properties. They may look different colors. You might be surprised to learn that nano gold is actually red, not gold. And so these new properties are also tunable or controllable as we control the size and shape of these particles. And that gives us a bigger toolkit with which to develop applications that are useful.
So your example there of nano gold, because I think of gold dust, and I think everybody probably has this image of something that glitters very yellowish. But you're saying this is getting beyond just the dust phase.
At a certain point, when you make something very small, it doesn't look like its bulk counterpart. It doesn't act like it. And so in the case of gold and some other metals, they change colors as you get down to the nanoscale. You're really talking about the particles looking more like individual atoms or small clusters of atoms rather than something bulk that we can hold in our hand.
Mm-hmm. And from a little bit I have read on nanotechnology, and I'm coming at this very much as a layperson, is the idea is that by making things smaller, and it almost seems counterintuitive to a layperson, you are making the surface area bigger, and that's the real secret there to what makes these things click.
That's right, Melinda. If you can imagine a bulk piece of gold has a certain number of these atoms on its surface, but when you cut it up into little pieces, you actually expose more of the surface. And by making it nanoscale, many of the atoms, the larger fraction of them, are on the surface, which can have impacts, including higher chemical reactivity and other things which may be desirable or undesirable, depending on the application.
Well, let's talk about the desirable and then the undesirable in a moment. What are some of the applications that are being researched right now for nanotechnology? Where could it be used?
Well, the exciting thing about nanotech is that it's being used potentially in every sector of research and development. And some particularly exciting applications that we're working on here at Rice include nanoshells, small spherical particles or round particles that heat up when exposed to a certain kind of light and can be used to actually kill cancer cells. So that's an area of bioengineering that's very exciting, and it's part of a growing area of biomedical engineering that nanotechnology could impact in a very positive way. And the other aspects that we're working on in CBEN include environmental engineering, like taking small nanoparticles and putting them into polluted groundwater, where they will harness the energy of the sun to break down those pollutants into harmless components. And so those are two areas, environmental remediation and biomedicine. Others include energy, personal care products, pretty much anything you might think of, nanotechnology has the potential to impact.
And in fact, some of those products are already on the shelves right now. We mentioned earlier sunscreen. What's the difference between sunscreen that uses has used nanotechnology nanoparticles and the stuff that might have been for sale 2 decades ago?
Well, some of your viewers might remember those beach movies where the lifeguards had the white paste on their nose, the zinc oxide paste, to physically block the sunlight. When you take those same particles and you make them nanoscale in size, they still block the sunlight, but they don't appear white. They appear transparent, and so you have an aesthetic benefit that derives from the nanosize of the particles. It's still zinc oxide, but making it smaller makes it interact with visible light differently, and that's what gives it the aesthetic benefit.
But there are some concerns, are there not, about maybe those are so small and they can get through the skin and perhaps do things that we didn't envision them doing?
One of the things that the research community has been interested in understanding is the biological impacts of these materials. A recent report by the Royal Society in the United Kingdom pretty much exonerated titanium dioxide, a different kind of nanoparticle, and said that we probably need a little bit more information about zinc oxide nanoparticles and their ability to penetrate. But that's still very much an active area of research.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What if it... There are other downsides that have been mentioned about that. There have been some studies suggesting that, putting these, what they call the buckyballs, into water. One experiment was done. And it certainly killed whatever microbes might have been in the water, but also it was getting into the brains of the fish that were in the water. As a researcher in this field, is it possible to rein in the bad effects of nanotechnology at the same time as proceeding forward with, making these other breakthroughs?
That's exactly the goal of our center, is to understand what the impacts of these materials are in biological systems and environmental or ecosystems, and then to tailor them so that we only get positive advantages out of them. And two areas of concern include a toxicity to living systems and also harm to the environment. And the positive message that I think is I'm able to convey today is that with the buckyballs, when you change what's on their surface, remember we just talked about how important surface was, how much of it there is. When you change what's on the surface, you actually change the toxicity, reduce it by 10 million times. And so we may be able to use our ingenuity as material scientists to keep the positive application, the characteristic that's important for the application, and engineer out that toxicity. And that's a strategy that we're working on here in our center.
So in other words, at the same time of trying to find the gee whiz factor of how good these things can be, also saying, okay, what's the downside, and trying to find something that would make that, would lessen the bad effect.
That's right. We're interested in proactive risk assessment. In other words, instead of waiting 20 years and finding out that these tiny particles have a downside, we want to investigate that downside, potential downside, today, so that we can use our creativity and ingenuity to actually minimize the risks to human health and the environment. If there's, no technology is neutral, no technology is without side effects or risks. And it's a matter of balancing the benefits and the risks to the greater good of society.
And that's the work that's going on at your Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at Rice. But is that going on across the field? Because it seems like this could be a very unleashed science that's happening. One can't keep tabs on what everybody's doing.
Well, we actually work in the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology, which is within the CNST that you mentioned before. We're a federally funded center by the National Science Foundation. And when we were established in the year 2001, there was very little research published on the potential implications, the downsides to human health and the environment, and that was a motivating factor for us to craft our proposal in that way. Since then, we're happy to report that through our efforts and the efforts of a growing community, there's a lot more of this research being done and a lot more federal funding going toward this in the United States and internationally. But it's still a fairly small fraction of what's happening of the total funding of nanotechnology. It seems it's a little bit more popular to fund the sunny side applications than it is to think about the potential risks, but it is definitely a growing area.
Right. Did I see a figure someplace that said 1% maybe going to studying the risks to the health and environment of what the U.S. government is putting toward that?
That's really hard to capture because an individual research project, like, say, the NanoShell project that I mentioned before for cancer therapy, that could be considered an application project. But in doing that research and in trying to commercialize those NanoShells, one must necessarily understand the potential toxicity of those materials. So within that same project, there's applications and implications. And so it's been hard to get a really firm number about how much is going in. But many critics agree that it's not enough.
Yeah. Well, Kristen Kolanowski, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Melinda. It was my pleasure.
Kristen Kolanowski is with the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at Rice University. This is the State of Things. We are talking today about nanotechnology. A lot of the work is going on in North Carolina to find uses for these one billionth of a meter particles and to understand what health risks they may pose as well. What are the prospects for nanotechnology to improve our lives? Have you formed your opinions about the field? And did you get that information from books or movies, or is it just a gut feeling? Just ahead, we'll take a closer look at the public's perception, and we'll talk with some folks about nanotechnology work going on here in North Carolina. We're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pankava. We are talking today about nanotechnology. That's the science of breaking things down to nanometers, that is, billionths of a meter, and then using those nanomaterials to make improvements either in consumer items or, it is hoped, in cancer medicine. Just ahead, we'll be talking with someone who is in that field, who is working to use nanotechnology toward better detection of cancer and a cure. And we'll also talk with a skeptic. That's just ahead, because there are those who worry about the unintended consequences of creating so many particles that can more easily pass through our bodies, slipping through the protection that we might have thought our skin provided. And some laboratories in North Carolina are also researching the health risks of nanotechnology. We'll continue our conversation on that in just a moment. But meanwhile, the National Science Foundation is financing research at NC State over how the public views nanotechnology. Professor Michael Cobb from NC State's Political Science Department has been conducting some of those studies. And when we spoke earlier today, we asked Professor Kopp why the National Science Foundation thought a public perception study about nanotechnology was necessary.
There are a couple of reasons, and I think one of it that's driving it is the concern that we'll have another genetically modified debacle in which you see this kind of ground-up reaction in places like wineries, in Napa County having a ballot initiative about banning genetically modified crop seeds in the area. And a lot of this goes back to the idea that the business industry at that time had a model of scientists know best, citizens can't reason about these things, so therefore we introduce it and we work on, you know, the PR side rather than actually working with citizens as the product develops. And I think everyone got caught off guard when the foods kind of got labeled in Europe Frankenfoods, and it stuck over here as well. You know, Frankenfoods, this idea that this monster out of control and can't be stopped, and it got negatively framed, and I think everyone's worried that nanotechnology, which promises to be this, you know, trillion-dollar industry down the future, the potentially, you know, engine of our next global revolution, could come to a screeching halt potentially just because people all of a sudden, you know, get exposed to the risks and don't like it.
Well, Michael Cobb, you have conducted two studies looking at the public's perception of nanotechnology right now. So let's start first with the survey that you conducted. What was that about?
One of the surveys that I've done is a national survey of people's attitudes about nanotechnology. And one of the first questions I always get is, why do you ask people about something that they don't know about? And sure enough, about, you know, half the population hasn't really heard much about nanotechnology at this point. But part of the other thing is, what have people heard? And so I was interested in, you know, how much knowledge have people gained, especially those that have become somewhat familiar with it. And the second thing is, you know, people are going to form attitudes about it. And so I'm trying to figure out what drives their initial perceptions, because I introduced some information in the survey about nanotechnology, so they have a very limited, you know, exposure to it, most people do, but yet they're forming opinions about whether or not they think it's going to be risky or more beneficial, and whether or not they trust business leaders to minimize risk to humans. Right? Where are they getting these opinions from? And it seems like they're viewing this through science in general. Right? Do they like science? Do they think that science primarily solves problems, or does it simply reproduce them in another form? Right? And that kind of drives their initial perceptions of nanotechnology, because, you know, it's a subset of this general science view that they have.
And so what are your findings then?
Limited awareness, some kind of ambivalence, which would be expected if you don't know much. And the other, well, first, the level of trust in business leaders to minimize the risk to humans is exceptionally low. Right? There's kind of a broad phenomenon happening across a number of domains, institutions, and people in which Americans are just less trusting. That's been going on for a number of years. But, you know, 60, 65% of Americans do not trust business leaders to minimize risk to humans. That's a bad starting point. And my guess of where they're getting that view is prior experiences and even different domains. You know, it could be Enron, could be genetically modified foods. But there are a number of things, I think, that people have looked at and have decided that business leaders don't necessarily have their interests at heart.
Your survey is also taking place against a backdrop where some people who you may have surveyed read science fiction. And there is one particular book out there by Michael Crichton called Prey that gets at this issue. And did you find that folks who had read that book were more skeptical than the average American about nanotechnology?
Yes and no, and that's a great question. While I have a couple of questions about their attitudes, such as risks and benefits, which one do they think would be more prevalent, reading Prey didn't seem to do a lot there. However, it really, the kinds of people that read Prey, above and beyond those kind of characteristics, reading Prey itself seemed to drive down trust in business leaders willing to minimize risk to humans.
Because that's part of the story. That's part of the storyline.
Yeah,
of the book.
The storyline in Prey actually has to do with people trying to develop nanotechnology and their interest in profit and developing this and the secretiveness of it. It goes astray, right? And there's this thing called the swarm that develops. And at first, it's supposedly benign, and as it goes on, they lose control, right? And one of the things that really drives people's concerns about new technologies is the idea of a loss of control. You know, there's two dimensions here. You know, how catastrophic could this risk be, and how controllable is it? Right? And this really drives home the idea that, wow, this can get really bad quick, and we can lose control in an instant. And I think that's what's going on.
Right. Now, another study that you conducted to get a pulse on what the public thinks about nanotechnology and its comfort level were forums. What did
yes,
you do there?
There are a couple different things. Collaborators of mine, Jane McCubry and Pat Hamlet, both at NC State, have been involved even more so in some of these little small group experiments where we've done. One is called the Citizen Technology Forum. And the idea is we bring people in. We recruit them from the community. Would they like to participate for a small honorarium? And this goes on for about a two-month process where people are given background materials. They're asked to read about it, think about it, come up with questions, and then as a group, try and deliberate about what issues or what aspects to the issue of nanotechnology, and I've also looked at global warming, are most important to them. And then they're given a task. Can they come up with a consensus set of policy recommendations? And the interesting thing about this is we're bucking a couple of trends in which people seem to think, in academics anyway, that deliberation just doesn't happen very often. And when it does, it actually leads to bad outcomes, in that in these small groups, the dominant opinion can just crowd out other minority opinions. And so it's called polarization effects. And people think that would be bad, that when you discuss things, instead of reasoning, learning, thoughtfulness, engagement, you just get kind of bullying tactics. And we don't find that at all.
Right. So that has good applications for you as a political scientist, apart from the nanotechnology.
Exactly. I mean, there are a number of, you know, the NSF is interested in this for a number of reasons. One, what are citizens' concerns without someone telling them what they should be concerned? What are these kind of organic interests, likes, dislikes, and so forth? And then when they can talk about it with each other, what kinds of things happen, right? Do we get better citizens, more informed, more deliberative? And that's good for democracy, and that's good for the development of the technology itself.
But do you think
people become invested?
Do you think that in the real world, that as this nanotechnology is being developed and there are no brakes really being put on it, it's hurtling forward, is there time for deliberation, or is the technology going to be presented in the marketplace and then we will, as a society, have to deal with what might be side effects?
I'll take the easy answer and I'll say both. I mean, again, you're hitting on the most important questions here, and that is, how will this develop, how will this proceed, and at what kind of pace? And, you know, I get the sense that it's going to be mixed, and that it's not a stoppable thing, that this will be happening, but there is a genuine concern to make sure that as it does develop to the best possible extent, bringing on board, you know, an integrative model of citizens and scientists and policymakers and business leaders working together to make sure that this is something that, you know, people want to see, people would use, people find ethical, and they're not afraid of. And I think, you know, the more people find out about any kind of technology, the less they are to be, you know, to use a bad term, you know, get spooked by it, right? Mm-hmm. If you know more, you're more familiar with it, a bad press release isn't going to all of a sudden overnight turn everyone against it. Mm-hmm.
Michael Cobb is a professor of political science at NC State University. We spoke with him earlier today about his studies into public perceptions about nanotechnology, and that is the subject of the day. This technology, a field of inquiry that's actually rather large here in North Carolina. There are researchers looking into ways of making matter so small that it would have an application for healthcare and food production. However, nanotechnology is not without its critics, and we'll be talking about that the rest of this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862 if you want to join the conversation. With us in the studio now is Joseph DeSimone. He's a professor of chemistry and chemical engineering at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State. He also directs the National Science Foundation's Science and Technology Center and owns the nanotech startup Liquidia Technologies. Thanks for being with us, Joseph DeSimone.
Good afternoon.
And Kathy Jo Wetter is a researcher with the Etc. Group, which urges some caution in this field. Etc. has an office in Carrboro. Welcome, Kathy Jo.
Thanks very much.
Well, starting with you, Joe DeSimone, you started Liquidia Technologies, a nanotech company. One of the things you're looking at doing is using these very tiny particles to find ways to detect cancer and perhaps fight it. Can you give us a layperson's description of how that would work?
Sure. This is research that is spun out of our laboratories at UNC and NC State. And I think all of us know people that have been through chemotherapy and cancer treatments, and often the side effects associated with chemotherapy are derived from giving a person a free drug, a drug that not only finds cancer cells but also finds healthy tissue, and they're very potent chemicals. And what we're targeting are specific delivery of those treatments directly to cancer cells so that one can spare healthy tissue and target the bad guys, the cancer tissues, directly.
How soon could this be applied to cancer patients?
Well, it's very early stage. We just developed a new method for making particles it's a very versatile method. Allows us to make particles out of the same materials that one would make bioabsorbable sutures, for example, and now make them in a nanoscale and then actually use that as a carrier. And so this is at the early stages, and working with physicians in a medical school to develop the efficacy on these strategies.
And I just want to know, are the particles you're using as small as 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter? Are they actual nanometer sized?
Or? Well, yeah. So in our labs, we actually can control that. And so we have demonstrated the ability to do this at 100 nanometers. We think we can do it at 20 nanometers, and we routinely work at 500 nanometers. So it's in that size scale.
And the size matters here because if it's extremely small, it can target the cancer cells and not the good cells in the body.
Exactly.
That's the idea.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Kathy Jo Wetter, the Et Cetera group is urging some caution as researchers work on a lot of nanotechnologies. You're calling for a moratorium until there are some regulations in place. Are you calling for a moratorium on the kind of work that Jody Simone would be doing, or are there certain areas that you're urging caution in?
Well, we're most concerned in the areas where there is a complete regulatory vacuum and where workers could be exposed to these particles. And in 2002, when we called for this moratorium on the commercialization of new products containing engineered nanoparticles, and also we called for establishing best practices to protect workers, there was one toxicology study out there on carbon nanotubes, and it was from the University of Warsaw in Poland, and it was a 4-week-long study, and the conclusion was that looks like carbon nanotubes aren't going to be a problem. Since then, there's been a whole lot of activity in trying to nail down this toxicology, but the point is that there are hundreds of products already on the market, and these haven't, if their ingredients have been assessed at larger scales, they would not, under present regulations, have to be reassessed, even though most of the commercial interest in nanoscale materials is that they're different. Small is different. That's what we're hearing over and over and over again. And if small is different for some properties, it just makes sense to assume that it may be different in other properties too.
Well, we heard Kristen Kalinowski just earlier say that gold looks different when it gets into these smaller particles. Mm. It's no longer gold, it's red. Is sunscreen an issue for you?
Well,
because that's a product that would have used the same substance, but in bigger chunks, mm-hmm. if I can put it as a layman. Mm-hmm. But now it's in smaller particles.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, that's right. So it is a concern.
And the concern is what? That would get into the body?
The concern is that because there's one major property that has changed, and that is transparency, that there may be other properties that change. And if all of the toxicology studies have been done on the bulk size of the material, then that may not be enough to catch what the difference is in the small scale.
Is the concern literally that sunscreen would get under your skin? I mean because it's in a smaller form.
Yeah, it could penetrate the skin. That's something that, in fact, I think the National Toxicology Program in RTP is working on looking at what the penetration is of titanium dioxide in skin.
But as you say, right now, because it's not a different substance in the view, I guess, of the Food and Drug Administration, there's no tests required.
That's right. I mean, that's the problem, is that even though there's a lot of talk about being kind of proactive, the truth is that there are products already on the market that have kind of slipped through this vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Joe DeSimone, what did you say when you hear cautionary words like Kathy Jo's saying here?
Oh, I think one needs to have an abundance of caution anytime one is introducing a new chemical or compound. And, the same for small molecules. I mean, small molecules themselves are the ultimate nano object prior to breaking it down into atoms. And so when we think about, if we think about particles or objects, those are aggregates of molecules. And, there are a lot of drugs that, in fact, are in a solution. And so they're actually, they're just the individual molecule and just in a nanometer size scale dissolved and floating around in solution, and those can be potent drugs. And so I think we have a lot of regulatory control when we associate with introducing new chemicals or new drugs. That in fact can be the right vehicle for screening these things. When you go from a topological treatment like a sunscreen and you break those particles down small enough to where they start penetrating the skin, that needs to be looked at, because that is a very different mode of transport, and it certainly one needs to look at that.
What do you do in your labs? Because Kathy raised the issue that the health of the workers in the labs. So do you take special precautions because there are these particles? Would they be floating around in
there?
Well,
yeah. So, in fact, we've been asking for, what are some protocols for out there? And I think to Kathy's point, there are none. And so we're treating these as the ultimate small particle, and that would be a molecule. And chemists are trained to work with molecules, and we do that within ventilated hoods and wear gloves and goggles, and we treat these compounds like chemicals that we don't know what their toxicity is.
1-877-962-9862 is the number. We're talking about the science of nanotechnology. A lot of the work is going on in North Carolina, both in trying to find uses for these very tiny particles, as well as those who are saying we should look into exactly what the side effects might be. 1-877-962-9862. Kathy Jo Wetter, your concern is also extending into the area of whether this might be used in the food we consume. And I almost hear parallels to the controversy that arose more than a decade ago over genetically modified foods in this country, as we heard Michael Cobb referencing before.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true. It's part of what we are concerned about is, again, this kind of regulatory vacuum where we certainly wouldn't know if there were nanoparticles in our food because there are no labeling requirements. Chemical compounds have been approved by the FDA for as food additives. Titanium dioxide, for example, is one that has been approved. And when it was approved in 1966, there was no nano titanium dioxide. So it's the same issue that the small size hasn't been taken into account on the regulatory level.
Okay. We'll continue our conversation about nanotechnology with Kathy Jo Wetter of the Et Cetera Group and Joseph DeSimone of UNC Chapel Hill and NC State. He's also head of his own nanotech startup company, Liquidia Technologies. If you have a question for our guests, our number is 1-877-962-9862. Your calls, and we continue our conversation just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We are talking this hour about nanotechnology. Joseph DeSimone is with us in the studio. He's a professor of chemistry and chemical engineering at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State. He's also owner of the nanotech startup Liquidia Technologies, which is using nanotechnology toward cancer cures and detection. Kathy Jo Wetter is with us here. She is a researcher for the Et Cetera Group. It is based in Canada with an office in Carrboro. It's a nonprofit organization that takes a skeptical look at the social and economic impact of nanotechnology. And we're taking your calls this hour as well. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. George is with us from Raleigh. Hi there, George.
Hi, Melinda.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi. As I was waiting on the phone, I thought of a second question. I was just asking, but
are you there? I'm afraid that your current technology may be failing you right now on your cell phone. We'll see if we can reestablish that, or if you can call back from a landline. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. And we go now to Russell in Carrboro. Hi, Russell. Hello, Russell? Russell?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello?
Hi there.
Do you hear me?
Yes, we do. That technology is working.
Yes. My question is, if your panelists are aware of the implications for the space elevator projects that nanotechnology has seemed to hold out, and whether they thought that that was truly viable.
Okay, space elevator. Joseph DeSimone.
Yeah, well, thanks. Well, that certainly would be a big breakthrough, but I think there's a lot of engineering challenges with that. But there are some things that are actually emerging that look much more promising. One of my colleagues at UNC, Otto Zhao, has developed new X-ray sources based on carbon nanotubes. These are low-power, portable sources of X-rays that are going to have a breakthrough in medical imaging for cancer and disease detection. Also in national security, in having be able to detect objects in a very portable manner. There's another breakthrough at Dan Feldheim at NC State. It's got some new catalyst work that's very promising for helping out with fuel cells and the generation of hydrogen. And so these are the kind of things that I would be pointed to as more practical and perhaps around the corner relative to the space elevator.
And when you speak of nanotubes, for those who at home are trying to keep score about the size of these things, we've talked of nanometers as 1/1,000,000th of a meter. How big is a nanotube in relation to a nanometer?
Well, they come in different sizes, and so it depends on who you're talking to. But their diameters tend to be less than 5 nanometers. But their lengths can be very long. It depends on who's making them. They often can be multi-walled nanotubes as well, and so they can be quite heterogeneous.
And that's carbon.
And that's all carbon-based.
Just like the buckyballs are carbon-based.
That's right, and it's sort of like graphite rolled up on it in a straw.
Okay. Kathy, Joe Wetter, any concerns about the nanotubes and fuel cells being used for that?
Well, the concerns are just the same that I've mentioned before. One thing that that Kristen pointed out is that it looks like that people can tailor, she used the word tailor, control or tune the surface to reduce toxicity. And, you know, and one point is that, you know, that may be possible. I've heard someone from Rice University talking about that, of fine-tuning the surface. And he said, but also the surfaces change over time as well. So if you fine-tune it once, you may not fine-tune it forever. And the second thing is that there's no one looking out to making sure that we are fine-tuning these and reducing the toxicity, because there is this lack of regulation.
Is there any concern about, okay, so you take this matter and you break it down into these billionths of a meter in size, of having a release of that into the environment? Is that, I don't know if I'm starting a science fiction novel or something here, but I think of what it's like here in the springtime with pollen through the air and how miserable it makes a lot of people.
Right. Well, pollen is made up of molecules, right? And it's an aggregation of molecules. And so the ultimate breakdown, if you will, without breaking chemical bonds, is individual molecules. And we in society deal with individual molecules free in the air. I mean, they become gases, and we're breathing those chemicals, oxygen, nitrogen. But they also can be dissolved in water and in other solvents. And so, you know, a lot of what we have in our body and regulating biological function is individual molecules dissolved in solution in water. Mm-hmm. And so the ultimate, carrying your analogy further, is a breaking down of an aggregate into individual molecules, and that's chemistry and ultimately biology and physics.
But is the concern that there are those things that may occur naturally and they're in the air, and sure, the trees do the pollen thing in the spring, but is there that concern that there could be a release of these synthetic nanometer-sized particles that can then get under our skin, into our lungs, into our brains?
It seems as though the lungs is the pathway for nanoparticles that are in the environment. The report that Kristen mentioned earlier, the UK Royal Society report, one of their recommendations is that the environmental release of nanoparticles should be avoided. And it's true that we encounter nanoparticles in the air all the time, but no one would argue that pollution is a good thing. I mean, pollution has nanoparticles in it, and we know that's, in fact, a bad thing. And so
cigarette smoke is another one.
Right. So there is a concern about the breathing in of nanoparticles.
Okay. We go to the phones. Anne is in Chapel Hill. Hi there, Anne.
Hi. I have a question for Kathy Jo. Kathy Jo and her group seem to ask for more information on the use of nanotechnology. I would like your opinion on the bills before the North Carolina legislature that would prevent the local regulation of plants or plant pests. I'm wondering how this prevention of regulation would affect us in North Carolina, and how this relates to nanotechnology. And basically, if there has been testing, the kind of information that you call for to show that this lack of local regulation would not be needed.
Okay. Kathy Jo Wetter, I don't know if you can get down to your organization works on a more national level. And
We actually are an international organization, and we're based in Canada. The local regulation, I know about this move to to eliminate local regulation of plants. I'm not exactly sure if it's related to nanotechnology specifically, only in general terms about kind of the ownership and control of technology in general. The elimination of local control of plants is a concern it shows that there is a problem with a technology kind of getting out of control. And this is something that is related to nanotechnology, that there is that what we've heard from scientists, we heard about with genetically modified organisms as well, is that they're predictable, precise, we can control them, and it turns out that that's not necessarily the case. And I think that's what those bills are about.
But would they not be the horses out of the barn already?
Right.
They're dealing with that.
Right.
Joseph DeSimone, I'm wondering, in your work, is the public's perception of the field of nanotechnology important? We'd heard Michael Cobb earlier talking about these studies that, you know, the National Science Foundation has financed because it doesn't want a PR disaster that it's ran into with genetically modified foods more than
right.
a decade ago. How important is that to you carrying on your work as a scientist?
Well, I think it's immensely important. I'm very concerned about environmental regulations the way it's been going of late.
But what
late
if it stopped you from doing your work?
Well,
what if they said, no, you shouldn't go any further until we know what the impact
is?
Yeah,
a moratorium on science is almost what that boils down to, and that's... I think that would be disastrous. And, we've got, I think they talk about the challenges of solving the problems of tomorrow are going to involve scientists involved in those. And perhaps scientists were involved in creating some of those problems in the past. But the only way to figure our way out in solving, improving health and well-being of people is to engage in science and pursue these developments. And so, I think this debate is immensely important. And regulations and safety are paramount. And we've got there's a track record of FDA approval on new drugs. And, I mean, the last thing you want to have happen are like very potent drugs and a meter dose inhaler that are just sprayed all over the place, right? You don't want to do those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so controlling of these particles if they're in solid form is an absolutely important thing to do. Controlling the particles if they're in solution are perhaps even more challenging. So all these things need to be looked at very carefully.
Okay. I think we have time for one more call. Trey is in Greenville. Greetings, Trey.
How you doing?
Fine. Welcome to the program. Did you have a quick question before we go?
Yes, I did. My first question was there a way to look at the ingredients section of sunscreen to tell whether the ingredients were used, were manufactured using nanotechnology, and also... do you have an estimated percentage of sunscreens manufactured using nanotechnology?
Well, those are good questions. Kathy Jo Wetter?
The first answer is no. There's no requirement to let you know if they're using nanoparticles. One thing is, not all sunscreens contain titanium dioxide or zinc oxide. So if those aren't one of the ingredients, then probably it isn't using a nanoparticle. If your sunscreen is transparent and it includes and it has titanium dioxide as an ingredient, then it probably does use nanoparticles, because that's the benefit for manufacturers.
Do you use sunscreen?
No, actually.
Because of this?
No, not because of this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I mean, there's a lot of oils and things that are certainly transparent that don't contain particles. And so I think one needs to be careful about a generality like that.
Okay. And we don't want to start a scare here, but one can look, but that's part of the issue you're saying, is it's not always known in the list of ingredients. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both for joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joseph DeSimone is a professor of chemistry and chemical engineering at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State. He also owns the nanotech startup Liquidia Technologies. And Kathy Jo Wetter is a researcher with the Etc. Group, which has an office in Carrboro. For musician Christine Kane, her notebook is as important to her songwriting as her guitar. In this installment of Christine's Notes from the Road series, she recounts a recent shopping trip with an old friend to buy a new journal.
I was visiting Boston last summer, and I got to have dinner with a former college professor of mine. While we were driving to Harvard Square, I remembered out loud that I needed a new journal. My professor said we'd get a journal in Cambridge before dinner. Now, he had been my creative writing professor. Now he's the chair of the English department. Given these credentials, I assumed he'd know the hows, whys, and whats of shopping for a journal. But when we got to the coop, and he handed me a Harvard spiral notebook and said, "Here," I knew I was in for a long night. "What's that?" I asked. "What?" he responded. "You wanted a journal. It says Harvard. It'll make you feel smart." I stared at it. "I can't use that as a journal. What are you thinking?" He stared at it. "What?" he asked again. I told him that the coop was not the right place and that we needed to go to one of those specialty froofy stores. Here he stopped and looked at me. "Froofy?" "Froofy. Anyone who has ever shopped in downtown Asheville knows froofy. In fact, it may be the new industry in western North Carolina. These are shops that smell of an unlikely combination of things organic. Mud, lye soap, tree bark, cloves. With droning music layering the sound of oceans, crickets, and wind chimes. This is artist's way froof. Froof for the soul, if you will. Aromatherapy burners, handmade journals, fountains that trickle softly, which, when purchased, brought home, and placed in your office, makes your best friend stop in the middle of a phone conversation and ask, "Are you peeing?" We arrived at the froofy store and found the journals. My professor began handing them to me one by one. "Hmm," said I, flipping pages. "What?" he asked for the third time in a half hour. "I don't know," I said. As we were leaving the froofy store empty-handed, he said, "Hello, it's just a notebook." But it's not just a notebook. It's who you are at that particular time. Certainly there have been periods in my life when a $1.25 spiral notebook from the drugstore aisle that smelled like crayons was perfect. Then again, I've also spent ridiculous amounts of money on those earthy, textury, recycled paper journals with grass clippings and flower petals mashed into the pages. The kind that force you to pause after each line of writing to blow various pieces of flecked-off would-be compost out of the way. These are the notebooks for the upheaval times in life. The "I wish Wayne Dyer would come over and tell me why I should get out of fetal position" times. When you need texture and earth beneath your writing hand. "All right, then. You like this one? Does it meet your requirements?" My professor was sarcastic. We were in a bookstore and I was holding a possible candidate for my next journal. "Yeah, I guess this is it," I said. The pages were tracing paper thin, perfect for bearing down hard with your ballpoint and getting kind of a make-your-own braille effect. "Good," he said, grabbing five of the same journal off the shelf. "Get them all. This way we'll spare the poor soul who happens to be out with you the next time you need a new one." "No," I said, swiping the books from him and putting them back on the shelf. "No, absolutely not. That's all wrong." I tried this once. I bought three of the same journal because I liked it so much. Then I never used a single one. Much as my professor hated this process, it's what I do. I rifle through hemp pajamas and overpriced soap. I flip through the different papers and analyze the book shapes and bindings. I am like Frodo Baggins on a most important mission. We were checking out. As I was handing over my credit card, my professor picked up a heavy gold fountain pen from a display and said, "Do you need a pen to go with your journal, madam?" I said, "Maybe I do, but not that pen. What are you thinking?"
Christine Kane's most recent CD is called Right Out of Nowhere. Her tour schedule is online at Christine with a C, Kane with a K, .com. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Melinda Pencava.
I was a reckless child with an eye for an adventure. Your soul was just as wild, and you lived your life like a scavenger.